With hindsight, there are many signs of stalking and coercive behaviour that we did not recognise. Everyone should know about these signs. This is National Stalking Awareness Week, and we feel there is a need for much more work to be done to publicise and identify stalking and controlling behaviour, to learn lessons, to raise awareness, and ultimately, as we all sincerely hope, to help prevent what happened to Alice happening to others.
One night he, well, more than once, he forced me. I didn't want to, and we ended up...
He forced you to do something you didn't want to do?
Yes.
Are you saying he forced you to have sex?
Well, I know, I should have stopped him.
It's not your fault, Helen. None of this is your
fault. He's not a criminal. Look, I'm making things sound much worse than they are.
You're not.
I feel so ashamed.
You have nothing to be ashamed about.
While some listeners have found it all very difficult but absolutely compelling, others say topics like this just have no place in the Archers or in Ambridge, and they've switched off.
Hello and welcome to Real Crime Profile. I'm Laura Richards, criminal behavioural analyst, director and founder of Paladin National Stalking Advocacy Service, and author of The Dash, The Domestic Abuse, Stalking and Harassment, and Honour-Based Violence Risk Model, and the book Policing Domestic Violence. And today is the second part of the interview with the fascinating Professor Evan Stark. So just to locate Evan for you, Evan is a leading authority on child abuse and domestic violence. He has won numerous awards for directing the Yale trauma studies in the 1980s with Anne Filtcraft, MD, and he wrote the seminal book Coercive Control, How Men Entrap Women in Personal Life, which won the Excellence Award from the American Publishers Association. So his book on coercive control really reframes domestic violence as a liberty crime and talks about deprivation and entrapment and women being held as hostages in their own homes. And we got into it, the detail of the book, and certainly the journey over the last couple of decades of what's changed. And this was whilst I was in London, and Evan and I were both sharing a stage at a national conference on coercive control, ironically. And we took time out to record this podcast in the breaks when other speakers were on the stage. And we're actually in the basement of the theatre in Dame Judi Dench's dressing room, rather ironically. And so without further ado, here's the second instalment of the fascinating and enlightening interview with Professor Evan Stark.
But one of the things that I think is ironic about the way in which the new offence of coercive and controlling behaviour has been enforced is that, so far as I know, I could be wrong, but I followed most of the cases. No one has been charged yet with stalking in the relationship. I have seen no cases in which stalking has been the primary offense, even though that was how Mr. Buckland interpreted it. And certainly one of the very key foundational pieces that you put in and others insisted on, and I certainly would agree with, why they're not charging stalking in relationships, I have no idea. But even though they've charged many other controlling behaviours, stalking has not, as far as I know...
No, and they won't be able to because it has to be that pattern.
But what
we did write into the prosecutor's guidance was that you can have multiple charges. And that's the bit. So you can charge for coercive control and you can also charge for a Section 4A stalking if there's separation.
But you don't have to, because stalking is listed as one of the offences that you can charge as part of coercive controlling behaviour.
But if they got back together, you see, and if that happened a number of times, or even once, then it negates, in the stalking law, it negates the pattern. That's the challenge.
As I understand it, I'm no expert on this, and you are more than I, certainly. But my understanding is that it may negate the charge under the public PHA stalking law. It doesn't negate the charge as a facet of coercive and controlling behaviour, whether they get together and separate and get together and separate.
So if So for the coercive control, that Section 76 can be used.
Right. And it hasn't been.
And it can be post as well.
Yeah,
so it's really closing that gap down.
But it hasn't been used that way.
So that's probably a training matter. Because when we were pushing for the law change, as you know, and with stalking as well, we wanted training pre the legislation being implemented. But of course, that didn't happen.
Well, so now it's kind of a catch-up. It's one thing that has been avoided. The other thing, I know we're jumping ahead of ourselves, but maybe for the later conversation, the other thing that's been avoided, as far as I can tell, is the, even though it's explicitly included in the definition of the offense, is the sexual coercion, sexual assault and coercion. I don't know one case that's been brought so far in which either the stalking or the sexual coercion has been charged as part of the coercive controlling behavior. You know, all the cases have resulted in convictions. The sentencing looks like it's averaging four, maybe more than 4.5 years. I couldn't be happier. They haven't taken a lot of cases. There's only been a little over 100 cases, probably. But the way in which the cases have been brought, and some areas haven't used the law at all, is very, 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 very effective. Every case has been publicized. I believe there's a rich understanding of this behavior as wrong behavior now. But unless we can get the sexual coercion piece into the understanding of coercive control, and I have some theories about why that's not being used, one of which is that the rape division of the police remains completely separate from other enforcement things, and they want to keep hold of the sexual assault. That's terrible, in my view, because no one is getting convicted of partner rape in Britain. I mean, it's
very true.
It's the most common source of arrest in sexual assault cases and the least common convictions. Something like 3% of partner rapes that are reported to the police and result in arrest are ending
charged convictions. Charged and convicted.
And if they end in convictions, the conviction is for the lesser crime of assault. So it's a shame. So we have to work on that. And we have to definitely work on having an understanding of stalking. Almost all partner stalking begins while the relationship is still intact. And so it's a continuum of behaviors, even if it extends after the couple separates. And so if we were to get that stalking behavior early on, the tracking, the cyber stalking, all of the forms of stalking that I know you're so familiar with, if we were to get that on the radar of local police departments, I think we could really have much more robust charging, and I think we'd get a much more comprehensive understanding of what this coercive controlling pattern is.
Yeah, that's an interesting point, the sexual coercion side, and certainly the lack of arrests and convictions, and that's something I saw in my research. There was a paper called Getting Away With It, which was a profile of the domestic violence rapists, and that was published in 2004, and it actually showed exactly what you've just said, the 3%, out of 450 offenders, it was literally two or three of them that were charged and convicted.
Well, you see, the reason for that, the reason for the low conviction rate, there are essentially three reasons for it. I mentioned them in my talk. There's essentially three reasons for the low conviction rate. The first is that many of these women have, in the past, made rape charges and withdrawn them. Not surprising, the man is still in there.
Given the history and the present.
Yeah, he's still there, intimidating her. So the withdrawal of charges should not disqualify, but it often does, particularly if your definition of prosecution is that you have to win every case, which unfortunately too many prosecutors in Britain still hold
feel
as
that
their
way.
Understanding.
Yes.
The second reason is that many of the women who've been sexually assaulted in abusive relationships have been assaulted multiple times. So now you have a situation of not a single assault complaint, not a double sexual assault complaint, but three, four, five sexual assault complaints, and you raise a whole set of evidentiary issues about a chronic complainer who yet is being raped by the same person. If you looked at that through the prism of each event, each rape event being an individual event, it seems like there's somewhat credibility issues. And the third problem, which is not easily understood until you get down into the police records. The third problem is that many of the women who are sexually assaulted have developed, because of their abuse, secondary medical or psychosocial or behavioral health problems, drug abuse, alcohol abuse, suicidality that weaken their standing as effective witnesses on their own behalf. So even though, like you say, many offenders, more offenders are, I think over 30% of all the offenders arrested for rape are partners, former partners, higher than any other single group. I think strangers, only a few percent, maybe. I don't know what it is here, but somewhere between 5%, maybe, and 10%.
It's about 6.7%? 6%.
So, yeah. So very small. You know, the vast majority of rapists are partners or former partners or whatever. So for these three reasons, because the women are discredited by having made prior assaults or prior complaints, or they've withdrawn complaints, or because they have confounding psychosocial problems, medical problems, none of those rapes go to conviction, go to even charge, let alone conviction. Now, take those same sexual assaults and put them in the context of coercive control, where we now have a continuum of sexual coercions, maybe rape on one side, but then you have sexual inspections, you have anal rapes, you have forced pregnancies, you have forced pregnancy terminations, you have a whole spectrum of coercive sexual acts, of which the physical rape is merely one, I shouldn't say merely, but is one point on the spectrum. And it's very important to understand that we're charging now, should be charging, the full spectrum of sexual coercion, not just the rape. Now, the fact that the woman has reported multiple rapes is consistent with the definition of coercive control, which is an ongoing pattern of coercive behavior. Now, the fact that the woman has confounding psychosocial issues and medical issues is contextualized by being seen in relationship to the ongoing stress associated with an abusive relationship. Now that she's withdrawn charges and then press charges on other occasions, is seen in the context of coercion and control. So all of the factors that have in the past disqualified partners from being credible witnesses to their own sexual assaults now become positives in terms of proving the importance of sexual assault as part of the course of control. So I'm very hopeful, except in cases where there's clear evidence of rape, nobody's going to question the evidence of rape. You know, you got a partner for rape, you can always add it on to coercive control. Same with stalking. If you got good evidence, so you always add it on. But I'm hopeful that we'll begin to see a much greater appreciation on the part of CPS and the police and the judges that sexual coercion is a continuum in coercive control, and that men should be charged with the whole range of their sexual crimes in the context of abusive relationships.
So would that be one of your, you know, if you could say for police officers, for example, because a lot of them listen to the podcast, what would be your top three things that you would want them to focus on when they're attending call-outs to people?
Well, the first thing is to open the window. In other words, you can't assume when you're going over domestic that what you see is what you got. And so now that we know with coercive control, and now we have a tool that we're giving police, and not just the administration of the DASH, which gives them a good deal of evidence. First, the administration of the DASH is now not given just to decide the level of risk, but also to identify a number of the elements of coercive control. They have questions on control, questions on sexual abuse, you know.
It's a journey of discovery. Yeah. You call it opening a window. I like that.
Yeah, so you're opening a window, and that window is not, and one of the things I tell police is that this is not an end of shift investigation. In other words, you're going to open that window, you're going to have to be willing to look through it. And if looking through it doesn't just involve talking to the woman at the scene, it means getting real follow-up, identifying both formal and informal sources of evidence, gathering information about past abuse, understanding what kind of documentation or form of letters or diaries or photographs or, you know, other witnesses who might have seen earlier evidence, so that you can build yourself a fairly robust case with respect to the element. It means getting familiar with the elements of coercive control and understanding that some of the elements of coercive control will be individual to that family. These men hurt women in ways that they know are specific to those women. So the evidence is not going to be as obvious and transparent.
It's
not going to be the same in every case.
Right.
And so it means developing a simpatico, an empathy with victim witnesses that allows them to talk about what he does when he really wants to hurt you, for example. Or, you know, what has he done that has made you really, well, made you do, that makes you really ashamed. So the first thing, I think, is just a willingness to open the window. And that means a commitment of time and a commitment of resources, not on the part of just that officer, but on the part of departments in that, you know, in the face of cuts. That's not always easy to find. The second thing is learning how to look through that window. What are you looking through? You know, and there you have to be familiar with the elements, of course, of control, and you need to identify the specific ways in which each of those elements of the crime, the sexual abuse, the physical abuse, the isolation, all the things that are mentioned, the emotional, psychological abuse, and the various forms of control, the deprivation, the exploitation, and the regulation, the ways in which each of those elements of the crime have been expressed in this particular relationship. There may not be any physical violence, or physical violence may have ended a long time.
He made sure that Peggy wasn't ever able to go anywhere alone. She wasn't able to go shopping with her sister. She wasn't able to go for coffee. She wasn't able to have any meals without him at her side. Wherever she sat in the living room, he was always right next to her. And that was a very strange thing, knowing that she only knew this guy for a few weeks.
I think the third thing is building and recognizing that coercive control is an ongoing pattern. And therefore, the relationship between the police and the victim has to be ongoing. Much in the way, you know, obviously, the desire of police would be to free someone who's living in a hostage-like situation in one fell swoop. But that's not what coercive control usually yields to. Because it's been established over many years, because the victim has maybe in various ways tried to leave and return, who's calculating her own risks if she tells with the risks of if she remains in the situation and remains silent, I think there's a level of trust that has to be established over time between policing and the community. Because coercive control is a chronic criminal pattern, I think there needs to be, if we're going to get an effective victim witness, there needs to be an ongoing relationship to that witness. I think that many of the institutions that we've established, like the CADA Dash and the other, which I know you've been involved in, and a number of the other the questionnaires we give out and so forth, I think those are all predicated, in my view, unfortunately in some ways, they're all predicated on the idea that the abuse is going to continue even though we're going to make an arrest, because the arrest is not going to result in any kind of serious removal, and that all of our energy and attention should be paid to victim safety work. You know, even though the victim's not actually at the table, which is always, I've always thought was ridiculous, of the dash.
Well, be it an advocate should be there. That's
well,
their voice
advocate,
in the process.
The victim should be there, but I mean, it's her voice that is missing. I don't believe the advocate, the IDVA, or anybody else represents her voice. She represents
it should be.
Voice.
I mean, an ISAC is there as well, an independent stalking advocacy caseworker or DV.
But
it
should
be
there.
The
victim should be there. It's her. It's about her in the medical decision-making process. You would never think of excluding the person whose surgery you were contemplating. So here is someone whose life is at stake, and she hasn't made the decision to turn her decision-making power of life and death over to IDVA. In our community, coordinated community responses, victims are always at the table. Not necessarily the victims whose case is coming up, because they may be in hiding or there may be a lot of other issues.
I know some who couldn't be there.
Well, that's what I'm saying. So there may be situations, obviously, where they can't. But basically, what I'm hoping is that many of these bodies, which have been heretofore designed essentially to do safety planning under the presumption that even though there's been an arrest, the abuse will be ongoing, hopefully we'll be able to shift the focus. And I'm actually hoping police will be less victim-focused and more offender-focused, and that we can eventually supplement the MARAC in England with the kind of MATAC that they have in Scotland, which is a central police function that essentially focuses solely on the
offender, perpetrators, on which came from the Met originally.
Yeah,
but yes, it's a great model.
It's a great model.
Well, it came from the Getting Away With It report. I mean, that was something John Grieve pioneered.
The problem with the Scottish model is that they still don't have a coercive and controlling offense. You know, it hasn't come out of committee yet. And I mean,
but they're debating it, aren't they?
They've been debating it for a year and a half, so it's about time they stopped debating and started.
Get on with it.
Yeah. So, you know, but this is a new thing. And I also believe, frankly, I don't expect that arrests are going to skyrocket. A lot of people are very disappointed by how few arrests have been made. And I can't say I'm not a little bit disappointed. But I'm not surprised because it's a new concept. Opening a window is, instead of taking a picture, it's a new concept to police. I mean, they have it in the harassment law. They have it, you know, and to some extent in the stalking law. But they still don't really get what it means to define a course of conduct as a criminal pattern. That's a long education process. Plus, the police don't have the resources.
It's a big step change, like you said.
But what I believe is that even if arrests remain fairly sparse, which I believe they will, the amount of publicity given to each arrest, if backed up by the kind of prevention initiatives they've been taking in Wales, and the Istanbul Convention lays out, and if adopted, would mandate the Home Office to support, I think that combination could really create a kind of gold standard in partner abuse policing. So I'm very optimistic in that sense about that happening. But none of this will happen without public support and understanding of this. I mean, the Arches has taken us a huge way along with this, you know, brought a real understanding of this. But the Arches, don't forget, occurs in it without violence. And so a lot of people still have the misunderstanding that the coercive control law is about only psychological abuse.
I mean, a step change, as you know, it takes time. You've probably seen lots of changes over your very long career. And certainly, you know, the stalking law, the coercive control law, they're two things I'm certainly very proud to have been involved in, working alongside many other people. But spearheading, you know, law reform is important. But like you said, there's lots of other things that need to happen. My nervousness with Theresa May and the Prime Minister right now is, you know, talking about more law changes, but it's actually funding services. It's actually about, like you said, looking at the perpetrators. And that was really one of my key focuses around, you know, the report Getting Away With It, is how do we tackle them? Because as you know, when people do get away with things, you know what happens.
Absolutely. Absolutely. You're absolutely right. And, you know, in the Prime Minister's defense, I would say that this has been really the issue on which she has done pioneering work that is equaled by no other public official, in my view, even though it may seem relatively modest. She has really been, and the present Home Secretary, I think, is very committed as well. And I think that, I'm very optimistic, even though I don't share all of the Prime Minister's political views on other issues. I think that she has really made this, she feels the depth of the wrong that's involved because she herself is an independent woman and can imagine what it would be like for her to be brought low by a coercive and controlling situation. I think she understands that.
Well, of course, she was the MP when Rana Faruqi's case happened.
That's right.
And she took it very,
very personal.
Personally and actually argued in Parliament. I still remember, you know, listening to her and reading in the Hansard afterwards what she said. And Rana Faruqi's mum, Carol, and I, along with Tricia Bunnell, Claire's mum, went to meet with her.
And, I didn't know that.
Yeah, and when we were talking about stalking and law change, she was hugely supportive. I've met with her numerous times and her aides, and you know, she really does want to make change.
I never owned the color red in any clothing, because they felt that it was a, I don't know whether it was a sexual thing or whether he felt that it was a control thing or he felt that people wouldn't notice me. I wasn't supposed to be noticed. And I wasn't allowed to bring any attention to who I was.
Many of our Real Crime Profile listeners asked for much more information on coercive control, and that's why we decided to have the discussion and interview with Professor Evan Stark. And I saw the opportunity when the fabulous Min Grob, who organised the conference in Suffolk on coercive control, asked us both to speak there. And I just want to give a shout out to Min, who looked after us very well. And I know, speaking for Evan and for myself, that we both enjoyed the conference very much. So if you're interested in learning more about coercive control, you can have a look at the Controlling or Coercive Behaviour in an Intimate or Family Relationship Statutory Guidance Framework. And this was the guidance I helped write with the Home Office. You can go on the Home Office website, or you can also find it on the Paladin website. And also, just to signpost you to the fact that we'll be talking about the stalking law and the difference with the coercive control law at the Paladin National Conference on June the 29th, called Raising the Bar, Best Practice in Stalking Cases. So again, you can go online on the Paladin website and you can register for a place to come to that conference. And if you're a professional or somebody working with victims of stalking and domestic violence, we can also deliver training, bespoke training within your region and your area. So just send us an email and we can have a conversation about it. So lastly, I just want to thank Professor Evan Stark, who gave his time under the constraints of a keynote speech along with myself at the conference. And he was really keen to squeeze this in. And we're really keen to get him back on Real Crime Profile. So watch this space for the next instalment. At Real Crime Profile, we're committed to bringing the leading lights and thought leaders into the discussion about crime and profiling. And there'll be many more of these discussions to come, because we believe that training and education and awareness is so important. So all that's left for me to do is thank you all so much for listening. And this is Real Crime Profile signing off. So if you enjoy our podcast and would like to support us, there are a couple of important things you can do. First, you can go over to iTunes and give us a positive 5-star review. You can check out our sponsors and take advantage of the special promotions for Real Crime Profile listeners. You can go over and like our Facebook page, and you can follow us on Twitter. But most importantly, you can share our podcast with friends, family, and anyone you know would be interested in real crime and the minds that solve those crimes. So thank you for listening.
Real Crime Profile is produced and edited by Paul Francis Sullivan. Sound engineered by Terrell Parham. Music composed by Simba Tsumba. Logo art by Jim Clementi. Real Crime Profile is produced by XG Productions and distributed by Wondery.
For advice and support if you're experiencing stalking in the UK, you can contact Paladin National Stalking Advocacy Service on 0203 866 4107, or you can go on the website www.paladinservice.co.uk. If you're experiencing domestic violence, call the National Domestic Violence Helpline, free phone, 0800 2000 247. In the US, if you're experiencing domestic abuse and need advice, safety, shelter or counselling, call Genesis, the 24-hour hotline, 214 946 4357, or go on their website, www.genesisshelter.org, or the domestic violence hotline on 800 799 7233.
So, Jim, what are you doing June 9th, 10th, and 11th?
I, like everybody else who's into crime, I'm going to be at CrimeCon. CrimeCon 2017 is Comic-Con for crime. Mm-hmm. Real Crime Profile will be there. We will be doing a live podcast from CrimeCon 2017.
So that's right. It's taking place in Indianapolis. Hopefully, some of our Real Crime Profile fans can make it out and come
awesome.
To a live podcast. And there's a great lineup of people appearing.
My brother Tim Clementi and I will be hosting CrimeCon. We will be introducing all the different celebrities and speakers that will be there. And I think there's going to be some interesting people there, because not only do we have Nancy Grace, but F. Lee Bailey and actually the prosecutor from the Making a Murderer case.
Oh, yes, indeed.
Mr. Kratz.
Yes.
Mr. Kratz.
Yes. It'd be very interesting to talk to him.
So check out the website www.crimecon.com and you'll see the whole schedule.
And our listeners can get 20% off the top on any tickets by using the promo code REALCRIME20. REALCRIME, the number 20. On top of that, if you go as a group,
they give you a further discount as well. So it's worth looking on our Twitter feed at Real Crime Profile without the E.
And we can't wait to meet you and talk to you and actually do a live podcast right from CrimeCon 2017 live.